Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 prohibits discrimination based on disability. Businesses of all types, restaurants, taxi services, and hotels are supposed to make accommodations for people who have disabilities. Companies such as Uber and Airbnb have shaken up these industries as many consumers embrace the sharing economy. But for those with disabilities, access can be limited and accountability is unclear. New research looking at discrimination on Airbnb found that hosts on the service were less likely to pre-approve the requests from travelers identified as those with disabilities. Joining us now is lead author of the study, researcher at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University, Mason Amiri. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Pleasure to speak with you.
Why the closer look at Airbnb in the first place?
Well, I think generally the rise of internet-based platforms like Airbnb threaten to perpetuate and possibly increase people with disabilities exclusion from these sharing economy platforms. So we were deeply interested in examining the responses by Airbnb hosts to the larger inquiries that we made from our hypothetical travelers with disabilities.
And how did you design the study? What your experiment set nearly 4,000 lodging requests, right, across the country?
Right, approximately 4,000, and specifically 3,847 lodging requests across the 48 continental U.S. states.
And how did it work? I mean, do people typically automatically identify themselves as disabled? I guess we're talking about mostly mobility things.
Right. So our hypothetical applicants or travelers with disabilities included travelers with blindness, cerebral palsy, dwarfism, or spinal cord injury. And my team and I created 25 Airbnb user accounts and made those requests across the states between June 1 and November 15th of 2016. And for each request, we assumed a fictitious identity and self-disclosed either any which one of those disability types and then codified the responses received by the host.
And, of course, you had a control group of non-disabled queries as well.
That's correct, yes.
And
right.
and how that was part of the 3,847?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Your study found that hosts were less likely to pre-approve, more likely to reject outright requests from customers with disabilities. What did that look like?
So essentially the pre-approval rate was, I think, 75% for guests without disabilities, 61% for guests with dwarfism, 50% for guests with blindness, 43% for guests with CP, and cerebral palsy, that is, and 25% for guests with spinal cord injury.
And what did they say when they rejected them?
So some hosts were truly sympathetic, and they apologized about not being able to accommodate us. They even offered substitutions, alternative listings that may be wheelchair accessible or more accommodating. Some even suggested hotels that were adjacent to them or nearby, within proximity, that is. Other hosts were a little bit more critical, and they had some comments as to that would not be something that you would hear commonly. And so it really did vary.
Like derogatory comments?
That's correct. So some hosts did respond. For example, we had one host that responded, quote, "Does the dog drive?" Which, as you might imagine, is truly, I mean, it's massively offensive, but it's, you know, it did range is what I'm getting at.
Right. And what is Airbnb has a non-discrimination policy. What about it? I mean, does that even matter here?
It seems as though the anti-discrimination policy that was placed into effect didn't really make much of a difference. They didn't vary significantly following Airbnb's announcement of a new non-discrimination policy. The users were required since September 8th to agree to the policy prior to each sign-in attempt, and the policy officially took effect on November 1. However, we didn't see a difference between the before and after effects.
And when Airbnb established this policy, what was the is it a carrot or stick approach? How were they going to enforce it?
Well, that's a question for them to answer, really. For us personally, we weren't here to necessarily tell a company or businesses of the sharing economy as to what to do best practices-wise, but it really was to inform them that there are discrepancies. So our suggestion, perhaps, if we had to have a suggestion, is that Airbnb should take extra steps to educate their hosts, ensure host compliance, and partner with disability organizations to ensure that the needs of people with disabilities, or in this case, travelers with disabilities, are well reflected in their policies.
Is it clear that the sharing economy is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act?
No, they're largely, I mean, the sharing economy, by and large, is largely unregulated, and that is where the sticky issue is. The success of Airbnb shows that it provides a desirable service for many travelers, people with and without disabilities, right? And it's a source of income for hosts in this case. It unfortunately raises a troubling question, however, of whether there is equal access for travelers with disabilities, and it's uncertain if the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, technically applies to Airbnb.
What do you recommend to Airbnb to curb the discrimination?
Again, as I said before, I believe it's a matter of monitoring, educating hosts, informing them. A lot of the hosts that we encountered were massively apologetic, and they wanted to know more, right? I'm certain that upon encountering them and soliciting during our study protocol, if I were in their position, I certainly can't speak for them, but I would imagine that they would want to know more. So maybe Airbnb should take steps to inform them better, educate them better, and also just monitor better if they aren't currently doing that. But again, this is the first step of many steps. And the sharing economy is fairly nascent, so there's a lot of room for growth on the part of Airbnb and other companies that are reminiscent to Airbnb. So it's hopefully the law will catch up to the sharing economy, and it will be, a productive and positive outcome in the end.
It seems like this is an opportunity. I mean, some people are going to be accessible, and some Airbnbs are going to be accessible and some aren't. Is there a category in Airbnb where people can list their properties as, accessible, that kind of a thing?
Yes. In fact, they have an option in their filter system as a host that you can select, quote, I think it's wheelchair accessible. And what we found in our results is that even hosts who advertise their listing as wheelchair accessible were more likely to approve a guest without a disability than a guest with spinal cord injury. And I think the comparison was 80% to 60%. So it does raise that question of, well, if you're listing it, well, why aren't you recruiting or accepting these guests?
Did the hosts mention the idea of liability as an issue for them?
From the 3,000 plus that we audited, I don't recall exactly if any host had responded with a legal liability issue. I think perhaps some hosts may have said, I need to consult with my insurance provider, which makes no sense. That's something to disclose. I don't understand why you would disclose that with a guest. Again, there's a lot of things that I would imagine companies like Airbnb would have to coach their hosts on in terms of best practices and the way to approach situations such like the ones that we initiated. There's a lot of gray area here.
The Americans with Disabilities Act, obviously passed in 1990, mm-hmm. Doesn't deal with the sharing economy.
Right.
Could it? I mean, is there room for improvement at that federal legislative level?
I believe so, absolutely. The study illuminates an area in which the law, the Americans with Disabilities Act, has not caught up with technology. The sharing economy, as I said before, is so very new and it's so very promising. It's a brilliant concept. It just needs to, or rather the ADA needs to adapt to it somehow. And that requires collaboration on the part of companies, leading businesses that are, kickstarting this initiative, and government, really, to collaborate and see how there can be a middle ground somewhere where, they can both be happy, and to help accommodate people with disabilities, because people with disabilities historically have been sidelined. And the rise of the internet-based platforms seem to make it worse, if it's not controlled in time, that is.
Sometimes research like this leads to a next step of research. Has that done that for you?
Well, For me, I study disability and employment largely, specifically as it relates to employer-based discrimination or hiring discrimination. This area was something that I segued into because, of course, people with disabilities, again, they're not just sidelined economically. They're also sidelined socially. And in the context of future research, absolutely, it's informed me as to proper methods. It's informed me as to, you know, building a stronger case for societal good. And really just the implications of the type of research that my team and I commit to. It's really a matter of creating that dialogue, that discussion amongst HR practitioners, people on Airbnb in this case, federal officials or government officials, generally speaking, to really think about next steps, future steps. Because as we see here, the technology is so fast and rapid and advanced that some laws may not necessarily be as relevant as they used to be.
Mason Amiri, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Yes. Pleasure.
Mason Amiri is a researcher at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. He's the lead author of the study that looked at this discrimination by Airbnb hosts toward people who identified themselves as disabled. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The value of the digital currency Bitcoin is soaring. The price has surged to a new high of more than $2,900. The values of other so-called cryptocurrencies are rising as well. Cryptocurrency, though not yet widely accepted, is attracting popularity, mostly from investors, and you can see why. This technology was birthed from a philosophy of a monetary system independent from governments and banks. But as is the case with any innovation, there are perils and pitfalls. Joining us now is contributing editor at The Atlantic and professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, Ian Bogost. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You wrote that Bitcoin is hard to grasp because it's almost like a technology from an alien civilization. So that's an interesting description, but can you give us a sense about how do you describe it so people understand?
Well, Bitcoin is what's known as a cryptocurrency, which means that it's a currency that's backed by mathematics rather than by a valuable property like gold or by a government like the Fed. So, you know, normally what gives money its value is either that it has a backing in some other agreed upon valuable material or that it's backed by the government. And so our Federal Reserve notes are backed by the U.S. government, by the Fed, and they guarantee based on the whole economy that they will be worth something. And of course, that value changes as the economy ebbs and flows. But for the kinds of people who distrust governments, corporations, any kind of central authority, that's an unacceptable state of affairs. So instead of using the Fed or any kind of standard like gold to back the currency, with Bitcoin, it's cryptographically backed. So every transaction is verifiable by means of a mathematical procedure that a computer performs. And this makes the process of using and of creating new bitcoins entirely computational. So it's quite unlike the way that we make and use money today. There's a lot of complicated details that most folks will never have to think about. But when it's discussed in kind of contemporary conversations in the media, it tends to be treated as if it were just another kind of currency, or maybe like a kind of script, you know, like the kind that you trade in for a particular use at a store or within a community. But it's something far stranger than that because it's created as a kind of residue of the process of verifying these Bitcoin transactions. And then when it's used, it creates this this chain of transactional verifications, which is called the blockchain, another confusing term, that essentially stores a record of everything that's ever happened in the Bitcoin universe.
In your piece that you wrote for The Atlantic, which is the headline of which is Cryptocurrency Might Be a Path to Authoritarianism, you can envision, you write how you can envision a way in which an authoritarian state could harness this technology, which is sort of diametrically opposite of what maybe people who distrust government and banks intended.
Yeah, this is the strange and unfortunate thing about Bitcoin, or at least the potentially strange and unfortunate thing about Bitcoin. I'm making some speculations here based on some research that's that's been extensively conducted by others. The kinds of political backing that drives blockchain and Bitcoin is sometimes called anarcho-capitalism, and the idea here is that the anarcho-capitalists believe that society regulates itself best when it's only allowed to use free markets, contracts, individual property, when central authorities like states or even like corporations kind of fall away and individuals become the central figure. And so if you start from that assumption, then it makes sense that things like not just the current state-backed currency, but state-backed authorities that back up contracts or that provide a law and regulatory compliance by which people can enter into the kinds of agreements that are allowed or make the kinds of purchases or sell the sorts of products that are licit rather than illicit, that all of that is essentially a problem for the anarcho-capitalists, for these sort of far-right libertarians. Now, the idea behind Bitcoin and blockchain is that they replace all of that authority, all of that centralized authority, with decentralized individualism. So everyone can do whatever they want because the value of their currency and then later of their contracts, which is another aspect of this process, they are not held by any one group. They're distributed throughout that community, and everyone has a kind of copy of this distributed ledger, this transaction record that assures them that, yes, you have the Bitcoins you're claiming to, so that when we make a transaction, it can be valid. You can't just invent a currency from thin air or use money twice or what have you. Now, the problem is that what this does is it creates a record of all of that material. And as there becomes a record of all of that material, then it's possible to re-centralize it rather than seeing it distributed throughout, thousands or millions of individual users. And we already see this happening to some extent with Bitcoin. So one of the aspects of Bitcoin is this process that's known as mining, which is a little bit misleading a name. In order to verify transactions, a lot of computer processing has to happen. And so as a reward, as a commission for doing that work, new Bitcoins are awarded to the people who own the computers that are doing the work. And that means there's an incentive to do this process of running the Bitcoin infrastructure. But as there become more and more and more Bitcoin transactions, the computational work needed to do that cryptographic decoding becomes more and more onerous. And then it becomes more and more costly. You need big computers and more of them, and then you need to power them and cool them and all the rest. So one thing that's happened is the capital demands of doing this process of verifying Bitcoin transactions and reaping the rewards, doing the accounting behind the scenes, it's consolidated the mining operations. And now there's a number of different groups, but a handful, largely China-based pools, as they're called, these sort of groups of mining operations, now control much of the Bitcoin mining power. And that means that they could collude in theory, or maybe they're already colluding. They just haven't revealed that they're actually run by the same organizations. And so you can imagine that very quickly re-centralizing either into a corporation or into a government. Or both, and this would give whomever it was that was in control of that material sort of full and complete access to all of the transaction records that people are using to engage in trade, which is quite the opposite of what the libertarians who originally invented this technology had in mind.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about maybe a dark side of Bitcoin and how it could be used in contrast to what it was maybe designed for, which was to avoid governments and banks. It could be used to fund authoritarian regimes. My guest is Ian Bogost. He's contributing editor at The Atlantic and professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He wrote about this recently for The Atlantic. We'll have a link to his article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Why does having a record, and again, this is something, this is the blockchain thing, right?
It's the blockchain thing, yeah.
Why does having I was wondering, why does that lead to re-centralization? And could you give me an example of how that happens?
Sure. So, you know, imagine that the federal government has a way of looking up every financial transaction that's taken place by any citizen. You know, that is the sort of thing that right now is somewhat distributed. Yes, there are individual banks, and you can imagine government or corporate agents sort of subpoenaing those records or trying to dig into them through some sort of backdoor or what have you. But that requires a lot of work, and even though banking is largely consolidated, it's still the kind of thing where you can have a certain amount of privacy and individual control of mm-hmm. what you're buying and selling and to whom. And, you know, one of the ideas behind Bitcoin was that, you know, things that are illegal to buy and sell became available to buy and sell
right.
By means of these black markets like Silk Road. And, you know, the sort of extreme libertarians who wanted to pursue those transactions didn't believe in their illegality because they want to eschew the authority of government. But in any case, once you re-centralize the record, then you have the potential to see what everyone is doing and then to connect those transactions to other information that's also known, you know, and that might be things that we already have, like, you know, public information about what you own or where you live or the kinds of places you go to, or it might be the sort of thing that is generated through technology companies, all of the stuff you give to Facebook and Google about, you know, who you know and your location, the sorts of activities you perform or the kinds of the things you like or so forth. So, you know, this is a hypothetical future, and it's one that maybe is harder to imagine in contemporary in the contemporary United States or in Europe. It's easier to imagine in regimes that are already leaning in an authoritarian direction. And one scenario specifically that you might imagine in China, where a lot of this consolidation has taken place, mm-hmm. There's been this proposal for a sort of social credit system
right.
In China, where kind of everything that you do, the government rates you. It's like a kind of super credit score
right.
effect. And that would be the kind of thing that you could very easily connect to every transaction that you perform and then to judge, I see that you're buying this or that, or you're transacting with this kind of agent, and that's going to affect how the government perceives you and therefore what you're allowed to do or what you're allowed to access in the community.
Very Black Mirror type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Black Mirror is sort of the place my mind goes immediately. These sort of, you know, strange dystopic futures that we can't really imagine in the present that seem very far off, but at the same time seem relatively plausible. And one reason that becomes additionally concerning is that this blockchain technology, which is sometimes called distributed ledger, I find it a little more clarifying, has now been expanded beyond Bitcoin, beyond just currency, to also work like a kind of programmable currency, to attach currency to what the developers of this technology call smart contracts. So now, with all of the stuff that you have in the world that's connected to the internet, these sort of Internet of Things devices, your mm-hmm. Google Home, or maybe your smart locks, or even your automobile, which is largely a computer that increasingly frequently has internet access, all of those things now might be able to transact on your behalf or on their own behalf to sort of engage in their own relationships with other people and other entities. And this provides, at least hypothetically, an infrastructure for all of that centralized information to be literally taken over by these, you know, governments or corporations that might end up reclaiming, you know, re-centralizing the technology that was originally developed to cut out the middleman.
How has it affected this scenario that Bitcoin's value is surging to currently more than $2,900 US? Does that change things? Because it's not something I can get into. Everyday people can't really get into unless they, you know, coalesce, you know, and everyone pitch in a buck or something. How does it work?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin as it exists today is largely a financial instrument. It's not really a currency. It's not really functioning as a store of value or as a medium of exchange, which mm-hmm. is what money does. You can hold value in U.S. dollars, and you can use it to exchange in transactions. With Bitcoin, it's very volatile, and you know now it's at highs, but it's been changing very rapidly over time. And then there are very few places that you can use Bitcoin to transact. You know, many of them are online, very few of them are in person, and many of them are connected to the technology sector where Bitcoin proponents tend to live. So I think it's important when we talk about Bitcoin, we look at its value, which is most frequently the thing that's reported about it, to realize that it's a little bit like speculating in tulips or even in startup companies. Mm-hmm. It's of great interest to the financial sector and to those who are interested in speculative finance more generally. But that life that it's leading as a kind of speculative commodity is really entirely different from the one that it was designed for as this distributed currency.
It's not the only game in town. There are other cryptocurrencies out there. Ethereum has had a surge. I mean, does that change the paradigm of all of this when there's several cryptocurrencies out there?
Right, sure it does. I mean, one of the reasons why having a single or a few kinds of cryptocurrencies would be desirable is because if it really is meant to be used as a medium for exchange, then you don't want to have 1,000 of these where you have to first discover, okay, I want to purchase something with my currency. You know, is it available for use? Is there a retailer or an individual who will take it. Mm-hmm. And of course, the problem with that, of course, is that as it becomes more popular, then we ended up with this sort of consolidation in the mining operations, which really risked to throw the whole project into disarray. So as these new cryptocurrencies have emerged, they too have been drafting on the appeal and the hype around Bitcoin and rising in value, but they also do different things. So Ethereum, which you mentioned, is a cryptocurrency that was developed on a similar technology as Bitcoin, but is really meant to be used in these smart contract situations where a computer can decide, okay, you know, I've determined based on some sensor information that, your key no longer has access or should have access to my lock, and so I'm going to turn it off unless you have enough Ether, which is the Ethereum currency, available to kind of open up a new week of rental in your Airbnb or whatever it is that it's controlling. Mm. And another thing that Ether can do is allow individuals or corporations or organizations to build their own cryptocurrencies atop that platform. So you end up with all of these kind of little private cryptocurrency universes, like almost like company stores or like Scrip. Mm-hmm. You know, so in the same way as when you buy a gift card at Applebee's or something, you can only use that Scrip now at that one place. That's one of the things that's happening with these individual cryptocurrencies. They're beginning to act a lot more like stores of value for particular uses. And then to get around the problem of why would you ever, translate your funds from U.S. dollars into these local currencies, they're giving individual developers they're called initial coin offerings, mm-hmm. kind of based on the idea of the IPO, where in exchange for building something atop one of these Ether derivatives, you get a sort of initial value that might rise. And, that too looks like it's the kind of thing that would yield a speculator's interest more than it would yield legitimate uses. It's all very confusing and complicated. And when we talk about these cryptocurrencies as though they're akin to U.S. dollars, we do them a disservice.
Absolutely. I mean, I try to just keep my mind open on all of this to understand the possibilities. Companies like Toyota and the messaging app company Kick are interested in this way, right?
They are. And, you know, it's not ever really clear whether the interest that a company like Toyota expresses in using this blockchain, this distributed ledger technology for smart vehicles, like, are they truly interested in it? Or is this just a way of kind of appearing to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, and to be with it technologically, so
right,
the market responds? The same is true of governments. You know, Janet Yellen encouraged the U.S. Fed to get involved in blockchain in some way, but didn't really make it clear what she meant by that or what it would mean for the United States.
Ian Bogost, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Ian Bogost is a contributing editor at The Atlantic and professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. We'll have a link to his recent article in The Atlantic. It's entitled "Cryptocurrency Might Be a Path to Authoritarianism." We'll have that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday, Apple held its big Worldwide Developers Conference. The event usually highlights upcoming Apple products. And one big piece of news that is that the company is entering the connected smart speaker market with the likes of Google Home and Amazon Echo. Joining us now to discuss that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Apple has unveiled its connected speaker. It's called HomePod. You've talked about the expectations for this. What are you seeing?
Well, my first expectation was for the name to be a little better.
Yeah, I know.
But really, so what we're looking at here, you know, this is not all that different in concept from what we've got from Google and Amazon right now. This is designed to be a high quality speaker with lots of higher end audio equipment inside of it and some nice microphones to connect, in this case, to Apple's Siri service and Apple Music. So the big focus here for Apple was having a speaker that you could very quickly, kind of speak to and get all of your kind of music interests from your Apple Music account. So, connected to all of your playlists and all of your shuffle instructions and things like that are all plugged in here, but also all of the things that you can currently do with Siri on your phone.
Is it just playing catch up? Are there any real innovations or is this the same old, same old?
Yeah, so a lot of this is it wasn't even catch up, really. It's still a little behind from what we've seen from Apple and Google so far, mostly because the only thing Apple was interested in talking about on stage was Apple stuff. So we didn't hear anything about connecting to music services that aren't Apple Music, whereas, Amazon and Google both have Spotify and half a dozen other, music services that are all kind of plugged in and work interchangeably between. But also Siri is just not yet as capable when it comes to kind of generic home commands as Apple and Google are, or I'm sorry, Amazon and Google are when it comes to, connected home stuff. And so a lot of that still needs to be addressed. And it's going to be a little while before this speaker comes out. So it's possible that we will see later this week during the rest of this conference improvements to Google's Apple's HomeKit service and things like that could tie into making this speaker more functional. But really, yeah, it felt a lot like kind of a half-hearted catch-up attempt.
I'm wondering if part of this is the insistence on Apple only, Apple only, Apple only is kind of becoming an Achilles heel.
It's certainly something that Apple has leaned on really hard in the past. However, there's a huge app ecosystem on your iPhone for mm-hmm. all of these different music services. And Apple has in the past been pretty upfront about, tying in other third-party services for things like Apple TV. When they first announced Apple TV, there was tons of support for Netflix and Hulu and a lot of other services. Including, announced here at WWDC was Amazon Video coming to Apple, TV as well. But none of those audio services were mentioned at all as a part of this HomePod service.
Yeah, the HomePod, it does sound like HomePort. I don't know. It's a strange name. HomePod, it costs $349, a lot more than the competition. What do you make of that?
Well, so this is actually very close to the price that Amazon Echo was when it was first announced.
Yeah.
Amazon has taken the price and dropped it pretty considerably. And, you know, Apple seems to think that the big focus here is the sound quality. They think that the speakers that they have in here are higher quality speakers than are what is in the Amazon Echo and what is in Google Home. And that certainly may be true. It's really hard to tell in large crowded rooms where they had all of the demo areas just
yeah.
how good the speakers are. It's going to be the kind of thing that's going to need to be tested, you know, kind of independently at home. But they were certainly very loud and they were certainly very clear. So it's possible that they are delivering that higher quality experience. But when it comes to the connected home stuff, you know, being able to speak out, I really feel like Amazon has the best implementation right now with these Echo Dot systems that are only $50 and they can plug into whatever other speaker you want and really do the important thing, which is have the listening part, the microphone part in as many rooms as you can put it in so that, you know, the ultimate goal of these things is so that you're not reaching for your phone or for your tablet or something when you want to give Siri a command.
Mm-hmm.
And at $350 a speaker, I think even...
Wait, you know, a speaker, not a system, a speaker.
Well, right, they're individual speakers.
Okay.
So, you know, even at $350 for a speaker, you know, even at that rate, I think most excited Apple enthusiasts are probably only ever going to buy one. And have in the room that they, you know, are most frequently in, which is very different from the strategy that Apple and Google currently have for making it so that you can really just kind of be in any room and speak a command and have your system kind of wake up and respond to it.
You mentioned the Amazon Video will now be available on Apple TV. And in general, this is part of a larger trend where big tech companies are working together despite the fact that they're competing. What is it? Facebook and Google or something are getting together to lay cable across across the ocean.
Yeah, so you know it's really interesting. It's there are kind of battle lines being drawn here because Apple and Google will work together, or Apple and Amazon will work together on things like this. Where it comes to making sure that there's video in individual sources and being able to shop from Amazon using your voice. On different things throughout the Apple Pay service, for example, whereas Amazon and Google won't work together at all. You almost can't find, Amazon, like a Chromecast. Google's Chromecast is never available to purchase on Amazon stores because it competes directly with some of Amazon's other products. But Google is also working well with Facebook to do other things. It's really interesting if you kind of, take a look back and see how these different companies are working together on what projects, but it's never kind of an all-in solution because on some level, they are all competing with each other on something.
Well, you learned that virtual reality will be coming to Macs this year. What do you know so far?
The big thing here is, a huge shift in how Apple is treating the Mac. It's not, kind of a lightweight, portability machine. For some developers and for some enthusiasts, and Apple seems to be understanding that and making sure that the tools are available for, in intense graphic applications. And VR, I think, is a good way for them to demonstrate that that they're ready to handle, visually intense programming and video editing and things like that. And the biggest way that they could show to do that was to offer support to Steam VR and to Unreal Engine and things like that, so that users will be able to take a MacBook and plug in what's basically a graphics card enclosure, a separate box that has a desktop graphics card into a regular MacBook, and with that be able to drive an HTC Vive or really kind of intense visual editing stuff. So for Apple, this is kind of the best of both worlds. They don't have to put, more physically demanding hardware in the MacBook, which would make the MacBooks a little louder and make them a little heavier, which are things that Apple very much doesn't want to do. But at the same time, be able to offer this high performance experience.
It was also announced that augmented reality capabilities are coming to the iPhone. They didn't already have that?
there were individual apps that were offering, different things. Like you look at Pokemon Go, reality component to that. But what Apple's doing now is making a platform-wide decision where there's a set of tools that every developer will have access to in order to build, you know, more in-depth, more realistic augmented reality applications that will work exactly the same across every iPhone. And that ends up being a much bigger deal for Apple and for people who are working with Apple. There's actually a demonstration on stage of Pokemon Go using this new, what they're calling AR kit, in order to make things look a little more realistic and in order to you know, make kind of the physics of throwing a ball, you know, seem more like you're actually throwing it to something that could be in the real world instead of something that's just kind of floating there, like you would see it right now if you were to load Pokemon Go. So I think that this is a lot more than just a single game. There was a lot of demonstrations on stage for, you know, very kind of complex systems where there's a tablet being pointed at a table and the entire table is just kind of taken over by this very intense scene from almost like a movie that was happening on this table, including a, you know, a small character that actually kind of dove off of the table. It was very dramatic. But the big thing here really is Apple giving a single way for all developers to kind of treat augmented reality the same way on the iPhone.
Was, in general, I mean, your impressions of the Apple conference, was it a wow conference or have there been more wow conferences in the past?
There was a lot happening here where it felt like Apple was kind of catching up. You know, the things that are coming to the iPhone are, you know, things that have been available elsewhere for a really long time and were important for things like the iPad to feel like it was actually a computer. You know, Apple's big message here is that, you know, the iPad is something you can create on, but it never had, you know, kind of a standalone file system where you could go through and say, this folder has, you know, all of these documents in it where I need for this thing. Mm-hmm. That never existed on the iPad, and it is coming as a part of iOS 11 later this year, where they're really focusing on making the iPad feel and function more like, you know, an actual laptop, which is a big part of it competing with things like the Surface and some of these other, you know, smaller, more portable systems that have that full desktop operating system on it.
Last week, we did not get to some Microsoft news. The company has announced a new service for gamers called Mixer. It's a rebranding of a streaming device, or I'm sorry, a streaming service called Beam. What's going on?
Yeah, so Microsoft bought this company called Beam that was doing this really neat streaming service for the Xbox and for the PC, and they bought it and you know, put a ton of money into it and ended up having to change the name over some legal issues. So it's now called Mixer, but one of the things that sets it apart from services like Twitch is what they're calling this side-by-side gaming, where you go to watch a video that's on Mixer, and instead of watching a single person playing, if you have two people playing together, it will actually show you, you know, both perspectives at the same time, you know, on the screen. So instead of, you know, needing two different feeds for two different people playing the same game at the same time together, you'll actually have a single feed with the two screens that shows you what's happening on both and get you feedback from both players as they're playing, which makes sounds really chaotic because it sounds like there's, you know, there's two different televisions crammed into one, basically. Mm-hmm. But with a lot of the demonstrations that have been done with this, it takes the whole idea of team multiplayer gaming and makes it feel a lot more like you're getting to see the whole team instead of just a single player. And that has a big deal for the way a lot of multiplayer games are going to be played moving forward.
Gosh, I mean, this says something that they're rejiggering this now, says something about how popular it's getting to watch streaming video game play.
Streaming video gameplay for a while now has been almost like watching sports replays, you know, mm-hmm. where you know, there's two different ways that people are consuming it. They're either watching it live as it's happening, and they're sitting, you know, watching as this other player goes through, you know, maybe they're you know, better at the game than you are, or maybe they're just exploring a game that you're not sure you want to buy yet. You know, the whole, you know, aspect there is that you're able to watch and explore and kind of get the experience without having to actually pay for the game or, you know, see someone else who's better at the game. But then there are, you know, players who will play for multiple hours at a time and then only show, you know, kind of the best things that happened during that game. And they'll put together these kind of sports clips almost of the things that happen. And those end up also being popular to kind of a different group of people where you can kind of show off the coolest things that you've done. So yeah, in a way they've gotten very popular, but for two kind of different reasons that are both interesting in their own right.
So the Mixer app, you can interact with the gamers that you're watching.
Yeah. So
how does that work?
A big part of this is, kind of a chat interface. So if you're playing on the Xbox, there will be a panel running along the side, similar to what's available in Twitch right now, where you'll be able to see comments come in from people who are playing, who are asking questions about the game or who have some feedback about the game. Not always positive, because, people on the internet are not always positive. But those experiences are there. But also there's what's being called Mixer Create, which instead of being just for video games, it is a part of your phone that will let you, stream really any kind of video. And it really offers a separate way to stream video to things like Facebook or YouTube or something like that, where you have this kind of single channel. Basically, it's your channel that you can use for video games, or you can use for, video from your phone, or really kind of anything that you want to share with other people. It can all be done through Mixer, which is a big part of Microsoft's goal here.
You can even tip the gamers or donate to their linked accounts. Tip them what? I mean, what kind of, like PayPal type of thing?
Yeah, there are options there where you can kind of tip the players as they're going through, and it's similar to what we've seen in Twitch. Twitch has limited this to certain kinds of players, where you have to have a certain number of followers, and then you'll have the option to do things like this, where you can accept tips from people. But basically, yes, it ends up being the people that are watching you have the ability to basically pay you to continue playing the games that they want you to play.
And then there's the Mixer Create app, and that's what you were talking about if you want to just stream yourself, right?
Correct.
And put together the clips and stuff like that. The Wonder Woman movie was a box office hit over the weekend. I can't wait to see it. Google's planning to harness the popularity to get girls interested in coding, which, yay Google, I guess. What have they done?
So this is it's actually kind of a little game that has been created where you're building, you are creating programs that instruct Diana to kind of run through different challenges. So it starts you off, you head to the first page, and it's a challenge where you have kind of basic programming instructions, and you stack together these instructions in order to navigate Diana through a set of combatants that are also Amazonian in this first challenge. But it basically walks you through scenes from the movie. And rewards you each time that you complete a challenge by giving you another scene from the movie that you get to watch.
I want to do this.
It's a lot of fun, and it's a very basic. It's as far as programming education goes, it really starts you off at the beginning, and by the end of the challenge, gives you a pretty reasonable understanding for how kind of the base commands for building programs work.
Did you see the film?
I did. I was there opening night later than I should have been.
With your kids?
No, I haven't taken my kids to see it yet because we were all in different places over the weekend, and I usually try.
Oh, that's
to see
right.
A movie
you're
before.
You're on the other end of the world. So, what'd you think?
I loved it. I thought it was an incredibly well done movie, and the things that I had issue with were very minor and just kind of demonstrated how picky I am as a moviegoer. But as far as the story goes, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. I'm looking forward to it. Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us. As usual, always appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Don't forget to check out all those links on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me as well on Twitter at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.